Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is John McMurtry. I want to emphasize John's books. I haven't mentioned them the last few times John has been on, but we want to talk a little bit about his latest one. Oh, his other books, his earlier books include Unequal Freedoms, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, and he has a new edition of The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, From Crisis to Cure. Another book that had a major impact on me is Value Wars. And I've read these books, and I recommend them to listeners. Important information in them. John, so much is going on, including the stuff that I focus on from day to day. And, of course, in America today, it is election day. Yawn. My goodness. If anybody thinks throwing out the bums is going to get you anything more than new bums, they better awaken to reality.
Well, It's a sorry situation, and the updated and much expanded version of The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, From Crisis to Cure, it's actually very depressing. I would like to be proved wrong. I would like the diagnosis to be, which is now over 20 years old, and it just keeps getting confirmed at deeper and deeper levels. And everyone, I think, knows a bit probably in our audience that the civil wars and conflicts that are going on from across the world, from Ukraine to Syria to Iraq to Chechnya to Egypt to Honduras to Afghanistan to Venezuela to Mali to Nigeria to Palestine, there's just no end of it. Every one of them has American sponsorship involved, both with money and arms and direction, especially direction. The person now in control in Ukraine, Yatsenyuk, is just a great direct puppet of the U.S. and has been from the outset when they installed them. In any case, the normal way, and I think what's importantly new about the cancer diagnosis as a macro cancer system, is that we're not dealing with most people who are critical thinking about these things think of imperialism, but we're not really dealing with imperialism in the classical sense at all, in the classical Marxian sense, for example. You know, it was a matter of subjugating peoples and even eliminating them by more developed industrial systems and productive forces, as he called them. This isn't happening. I mean, that's bad enough, but this is much worse. It's much worse insofar as it's not productive. It's the opposite of productive. It's destructive, and it involves much more than people. It involves much more than political economy. It goes to every level of life organization. So now we have virtually, you know, aside from all those conflict setups that are just basically, I came to a saying, by the way, last night when I was thinking about our program, that people are not allowed to live if their lands are desired by foreign invaders is really what it comes down to. That's a simple expression. They're just not allowed to live, and that's what's happening in eastern Ukraine right now and in Palestine and so on. You can go through the whole list. And what is happening, though, is it's not just the people. It's just the whole, every social and ecological life support system on the planet is degrading and collapsing. You know, the air and the soil and the water, and I've mentioned this before, I'll just quickly, it's everything. They all cumulatively degrade as the climates and the oceans destabilize, and I could go into long descriptions of each one of these. They're all interconnected. The species become extinct at a spasm rate, 1,000 times the background rate of extinction and going up. Pollution cycles and volumes increase to endanger life systems on all planes. just at the very same time as the rich are avoiding all taxes and all social sector bases that could meet these problems are being privatized, and the taxes are being reduced or avoided to the point of almost $30 trillion a year worldwide. And all the while, these money sequences, these transnational deregulated money sequences, which are behind every single one of these crises. But no analysis joins the dots. None of them do. Not one, except the cancer stage of capitalism, which was out to connect the dots from the beginning with the diagnosis. It was connecting the dots, which no one does. The ecologists don't do it. The political scientists don't do it. You know, they all have their silo expertises. So that's what led to the diagnosis, was connecting the dots. And I couldn't see that there was any other diagnosis, and it's been medically refereed, but a cancer system at the macro level of life organization. But still, we have an awakening going on. We have a great famous book that's come out called, you know, Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. Well, this book just presupposes the very same basic problem that we have, which is that all wealth is basically capital wealth. That's just a presupposition in an equation he makes right from the start. And this is the way it is with political economy in general, and economics in particular. And everything is, you know, it's only if it's marketable does it have any value at all. And all growth, therefore, is of money value. So no one asks, well, what kind of growth? We all have, everybody's saying a return to growth or more growth is essential. That seems to be a unanimous cry from across parties. But what kind of growth? All the only growth they're really talking about is the growth of transnational money sequences, which, you know, sell commodities as their middle term, or they don't sell commodities, they just bet, which is becoming increasingly preponderant. So what happens out of all this, and I'm being very, because this is like giving a lens of the whole argument that, as I say, has been going on for 20 years. What happens out of this a priori structure of economic thought, and with it, human thought in general, is that no life need or life support system exists inside the framework of calculation and the framework of understanding. It just doesn't exist. There isn't such a concept or category in all of economics. No life capital. Life capital, which is wealth that produces more wealth without loss and cumulative gain. That's the real meaning of capital. Wealth, life wealth that creates more life, produces more life wealth without loss and with cumulative gain. That's the real meaning of capital, which we've totally lost. And even people on the left, even great critics like, well, Marx himself or David Harvey in the present, none of them have any category for life capital. Well, life capital is the missing life base of the whole thought system, of the whole economic system. And so being life blind as it is, it just overruns everything. And so we have, you know, and has no idea of what it's doing because all life values are excluded. So that even as the life bases of the world collapse, as I said, at every level of life organization, there's no cost registered in any economic account or indeed government account of all this destruction of our very life base and our very life capital base. And so we have basically a system that is destroying the world with all the hallmark characteristics of a cancer, globalizing, metastasizing cancer invasion, and there is no record or connection of what it's doing in its systematic destruction of life. It's like a cancer was invading our body and we had no idea that it was going on, which is in fact what happens. And we don't know what is going on because our immune systems, our defense systems, our life defense systems haven't spotted what the invasion is, which is a fatal invasion. And so we have every step, every step of all the ecological destruction and all the social collapses that are going on, and it's not just in places of war, that's just where people resist, it's also in places of peace, from the European Union to the U.S., it's happening at the peace level at the same time. They're all governed by an absolutist value code, and this is what's really behind the whole thing, which, again, most analysis leaves out. They don't, you know, they think of values as just right-wing propaganda. Indeed, that's true, but a value system is the regulating code for every decision, for every step of everything that goes on, and that value system is not understood. It's not even examined. That's why you like value wars, because I get into that value code basis. It's the driver and the organizing principles of everything that goes on, and it's done automatically, as if they're, you know, as I called it, as a metaprogram. So we have a ruling game, we have a ruling global game, really, of the economy, so-called economy and global competition, but really what it in fact is, when you decode it, it's just only self-maximizing money value transactions towards maximum aggregate growth, and only gains in the money of money value, whether it's money value of commodities or, more important, the money value of profits, only money value gains count as gains, count as value at all, while all life requirements, whether they're organic, whether they're ecological, whether they're social, they're all sacrificed for the exponential money, these exponential money sequence multiplications through life hosts across the world. And so this is where we get the actual cancer system developing right in front of us, but no one will recognize it. It's taboo to recognize it. And so what you have, really, and I've broken it down in a way that, very simply, to try to make it as clear as possible, the insanity, it's an institutionalized insanity, a normalized metaphysical stupefaction that's going on here, where we're all locked into, even if we're observers who don't like it, we're locked into this way of seeing things. And the first step of it is we haven't found the unifying causal mechanism behind it all. The climate destabilization that's occurring is not connected to anything else. So we look to the specific cause of this, and we're learning it, and, you know, and it takes a long while, and everyone denies it and all that. But finally we get it, well, it's an anthropogenic or human-made carbon production that is doing most of it. But that's not connected to anything else. That's not connected to the extinction of species. That's not connected to the air quality, etc. What we have is a unifying causal mechanism, which is behind all the ecological degeneration, all the civil wars that are being fomented by the U.S., all the collapses of social infrastructures across Europe and in the U.S. and in Canada and everywhere, indeed. Behind them all is this set of, and I'm just going to go into a set, and it's going to be a somewhat long set, but each one of these equations have been built in a priori into the frame of collective mind and, of course, of corporate mind and the economic decision and strategy apparatus. Every one of them have been built in, and we don't recognize that each one of them is crazy. Now, the first one is that more money value is always good for each and all. And I'm not going to get into explaining why that's true, but, you know, but the fact that people play the lotteries and that it's always thought lucky, that shows that it's even true for people who don't have much money. And rationality, and here we get to the real core of it at the level of human learning and the level of science, that rationality is equated to consistently maximizing money value for yourself. That's it. That's it. And you do it, period. That's all what is rationality. Rationality, therefore, is not caring about anybody else. It's built right in as the first axiom of economics. Well, this has implications. It means that all other choices and outcomes are irrational. if you're thinking in terms of, for example, how will this be in terms of other people's benefits and how are they going to last or survive if I make a big gain here inside this corporate money sequence game, those questions are not allowed. You know, they're just ruled out a priori. So all other choices are viewed as irrational, and so one can't appeal to any other standard or of justice or right whatsoever. There is no standard of justice or right in this whole thought system except more money value. You'll find that's true of every single positive thing that's said. It's an increase of money value for some or in the aggregate or in commodities or in profits, but that's the underlying principle. And so you can't appeal to any other standard of justice or right, and that's why we're just floundering. We don't know what we're doing because we have nothing to appeal beyond it. And then this is, you know, whenever anybody says this is, you know, this is killing us, they blame the economy. It's not the economy. It's the cancer. And but this is called the real world and the free world at once. I mean, you know, if you've got to adapt or you don't live. And so all life-giving concerns, which you and I have, that's basically why we do what we do, because we're grounded in life concern for not just ourselves, but really for humanity as a whole, and for indeed our fellow life on the planet, and indeed life on the planet. That's where people really live, especially as we evolve to higher levels of understanding. But all of that is excluded right from the part of from the get-go. And so the ruling, it follows then that the ruling command of all societies is this private money sequencing to more without barrier. That's the ultimate social good. That's, and you look at anything that's going on, any value statement of what we must do, where societies must go, why we're doing this or why we're doing that. It's always about, you know, we've got to increase growth, or we've got to return growth, or we've got to enhance growth. It's always about growth, and growth is only transnational money sequences through commodities to more money. That just metastasizes across the world in bigger and more limitless amounts. So any other system, and this also explains why any other system that is an alternative, say Venezuela tries to create an alternative, or even Iraq had before they put in Saddam, and even then they couldn't get rid of it, a socialist system where they had free university education. Same thing as in Libya, free university education, free money paid towards your first home if you have a family, and free health care of the highest quality. All these things, that's an alternative. That's run by the public sector and publicly owned oil in those two cases. That's all becomes the enemy. That's what makes them the enemy. Underneath all the, you know, all the ideological and propaganda and reverse projection is that they have a different way of doing it. They don't go through the private money sequences limitlessly to the top, depriving everybody else as prosperity and freedom. They do another way. Well, that war is made upon them. And so any other system is wrong and evil. That's why original communities, that's why socialism, that's why the welfare state even, all of these are repudiated as bad and evil. And then that clears the way, and we've seen the clearing the way going on. And you can take every one of these principles I'm mentioning, you can apply it to the Ukraine crisis, for example, or whatever crisis we're going into, or Venezuela, or what other ones we've done. You can apply every one of those principles to what's going on, and seeing that is the machinal lockstep of value lock that is governing and propelling and driving the whole thing every single step. And so the self-multiplying money sequence to ever more to the top is understood as the only way you can survive. And you hope to be lucky to be one of those, you know, on the side of one of those multiplying money sequences, everybody wanting to see their stocks go up and so forth. And they're forcing everybody through their pensions, through the childhood education that comes to be highly expensive, is forcing you into the stock market in order that you two join the money sequences as the only way of life on Earth as it is destroying Earth. And so this is what is. This is the logic, the inner logic of the macro cancer system across borders. So what happens in terms of theory and understanding of this? Well, actually, in theory as well as practice, in peace as well as war, whether it's within or without nations, the only rational strategy, and this you'll just see what the U.S. does insofar as it's able to do it, is to advance the money value leverage in place without self-limit. That's the very minimalist way of describing what is always going on. It's always expanding. It's always metastasizing. It has to grow and devour to live, and it has no committed life function. So however monstrous, you know, and this is the only intelligent life actually recognized in international agreements and discussions on trade and so forth, is this self-maximizing rationality of the nation. So that we have no one really saying, hey, we've got to get underneath that. We've got to get down to the fact that we all share a common life base which we're destroying. That just doesn't make sense except in isolated instances where nothing is connected to anything else. So however monstrous the results are, you are indifferent to them inside the system of strategic movement because they don't count. They, you know, that's not the game. It's like saying, you know, why should I hold the football? Why don't I give the football over to somebody else? It's all based on a game theory. This is a thing that's not known, but game theory came out of the Second World War as a strategic mechanism, and they got it into a mathematical form that all, you know, that all rationality inside games was self-maximizing choice inside the rules of the game. And then the game becomes all there is. And so that's really what's behind it, behind economics and so forth, is this mathematical game theory that proves this on the level of a game. But of course, reality and life conditions and whether things go on or not, or whether needs are met, or whether the ecology is maintained is sustainable, none of this counts in. And so we have, in fact, even Eleanor Ostrom, in her Nobel Prize-winning book called Governing the Commons, she follows this game theory. She makes the best that's possible out of it. But the commons themselves, everybody is an atomic self-maximizer. And what they do, if they drop this atomic self-maximization as the principle of their life, then what happens is they're categorized, even by her, but by the disciplines in general, as suckers. So if you give up anything that is properly yours or you can make a right claim to it under this system, then you're a sucker. That's the language of it. So again, you see the way it rules out any other alternative. It rules out any other alternative by armies, and it rules out any alternative in the theoretical inner sanctums of theory. And so we have basically what follows from this. And it follows from it deductively. There's no other way you can go once you start tracking it logically, and that's the way it works inside game theory, which I've had to learn, learn the inside mathematics and so forth of it. What it is the system implies a war to the death by the rich and weaponed over peoples and nations as right and good. But that just follows. So all the things that we are enraged about, we are in a moral indignation, we almost melt. We're so furious at how evil this thing is. It's built into the game. And so since the global money sequences have no committed life function, or they're limitless self-multiplication because it all goes to the top, that's the way it's structured, all bases and conditions of life are cumulatively, and it follows from the game, because they don't count, their losses aren't entered into accounts, they're looted, polluted, and devoured. That follows. It's all built in. And this is what not even Marxists get, you know, how deep this thing is, because it goes back to a value code, an inner logic that they, you know, that political science and so forth don't do. That's, I mean, I got into it through basically moral philosophy and, or more broadly, value theory. But nobody else, you know, it was sort of like a lone trip doing that, because that isn't what is normally done. In value theory and in moral philosophy, you're usually just dealing with individual agents called agent-relevant choice. So you never get to the institutions. You never especially get to the structure of globalization. It's just ruled out, blinkered out a priori. So the value system gridlock that regulates and governs everything. And I'm glad for you to find, for example, in Ukraine, I know we're going to get into today, any step of what's going on the U.S. side there, because Putin doesn't agree with this, nor does the Donbass region. They don't agree with it, but that's why there's a war on. This is the war. The war is to keep imposing this, and they want to impose it not only through Ukraine, they want to impose it through Russia itself, and on they go. So this is the cancer cold behind every growing crisis and collapse. That's the argument. And what I do inside the text is show it very, you know, with a lot of documentation, step by step. I'm making a very simplified account here, and case by case by case, really good, beginning with Chile in 1973. And so, the question that what is unrecognized is really the key question, is the joining of the dots, and even revolutionaries don't get it, is that the entire value system is in principle disconnected from universal life requirements of every kind. That means
John, if I could make one point. Yeah. I think your cancer analogy is the most important one I know. The most important one I know. We literally are destroying ourselves. We're destroying ourselves, destroying the ecology. We have an unsustainable way of life. And if a way isn't found to change this, at some point down the road, humanity is really at risk. So people.
Well, we're at risk now. And all the people that are suffering under it are very much at risk. I was just reading about El Salvador, for example, who's got a progressive government in, by the way. That's one good thing that's going on in Latin America. They're getting more, you know, they have an FMLN, a leader of the prior, you know, the revolutionary movement against the El Salvador death squad dictatorship. Their 95% of their land is vulnerable to and at risk under the climate destabilization. The thing is, we haven't joined all these things together. The climate, you know, for example, climate change is a euphemism. It's really climate destabilization, one-way trend. And warming is a euphemism. But even when we get it, that we've got to do something about it, all these other principles kick in to reject it. So what I'm saying about these principles, these connect, these join all the dots. Everybody realizes something very badly has gone wrong. You can walk, as I have done, travel around the world, and you'll find people who are thinking people, they all know something's gone terribly wrong. They all know that it's unsustainable. Even the people inside the World Bank know it's unsustainable. But what they haven't got is the common cause. They can't get to the common cause because that's what they presuppose as the very nature of freedom and their lives and who they are. And so that's why these words and these understandings don't get anywhere. And so that's why I get to the idea of, well, how do you solve this thing? And I'm going to give a clue to the way you have to solve it. Is everything. It's everything humans do eventually. It's by knowledge. to understand what's actually going on. Understanding is the highest, to quote Spinoza, understanding is the highest human activity, and learning towards understanding is the only freedom. And I think that's true. And I think it's especially true now, is that what we lack most of all is understanding of the unifying causal mechanism, which is the system itself, the globalizing system itself, is the problem. But that's a taboo to even think. But knowledge is the only way you can get past it. Knowledge has got us as far as we've gotten as human beings. Knowledge always wins in the end. That's really the principle. So, and then common knowledge, that it's distributed. The more knowledge is distributed, the better it gets, the more, you know, circulated and disseminated it is, and the more developed it becomes. It's like language itself. The more it's used, the more it's shared. The more it grows, the more it develops. Now, with my work, what's interesting about it, I always have publishers, but I will never get a grant for any of this stuff from anybody. They're just, you know, it's taboo what you're doing, what you're saying, even though it's proven, even though you can prove it in front of the highest experts, it's just shut out. And that's the breakdown of our whole social immune system, our whole social defense mechanism, is at the level of social intelligence itself. We have a breakdown of social intelligence of an unprecedented global breakdown of social intelligence that is the worst in terms of its stupidity and its life blindness in all of history by far. And so how do you get at it with we know it's a disease, we know it's metastasizing, we know it has all the hallmark characteristics of a cancer, we know we can apply it to all the places, Iraq, Libya, Ukraine, Syria, all these places it can be applied as just another case, another metastasis of this cancer system, and the results keep verifying it. But what we have holding it in place is that, just like a cancer, a cancer always invades and occupies where there's atrophy of response to its destructive growth, on the micro level as well as the macro level. And we have, the atrophy of response has been enforced. First, it was enforced by death squad dictatorships throughout Latin America and Southeast Asia. And then it's worked its way up after shell shocked the whole world and the people into, what can you do? They just kept on killing and kept on having death squad dictatorships. Is they found a better way, which is the transnational trade treaties, which are made in secret. They're written by corporations, and they grant only rights to corporations to do everything that formerly they were trying to do by force on the ground. They don't need to do it by force on the ground. They've got these bot politicians, and they just sign these deals. No right is recognized but transnational money sequences to have more. That's the only right. Every regulation in thousands of pages is governed by that sovereign right, and that's the sovereign right of the world that they've got going every which way. As we know, there's Trans-Pacific Partnership, Transatlantic Partnership, all these things called partnership, the European Union. That's why the European Union's tanking. Everywhere they go, they bear, they're the essential vehicle of the cancer system. And so then, everything's going wrong, so you just start blaming terrorism. That's the function of terrorism, is that you just blame terrorists for anyone who resists, any remnant that's desperate and suicidally resists this monstrous machine, then is a terrorist. Or if they seem to be, if you can call them a terrorist, and then, you know, it becomes pretty vague about who a terrorist is, it basically becomes anybody who opposes the system. That's the way they're trying to work it up. By the way, I've got a whole thing, I don't know whether you saw my article on Harper's terrorism game.
Yeah.
On on global research. Yes, it was up as sort of the head story for days on end. Yeah, well, as soon as we had these terror incidents going on in Canada, and it was so obviously a setup, and what I did was really basically demonstrate right from the get-go that all the evidence points to these as being a setup for Harper. And we can get into that today or another time about just how that, and then it went all the way. Did you hear about the terrorism in Canada, the terrible
indeed, yeah, made headlines.
Yeah, and it went all over the world, man. It went everywhere. Oh, Canada's had terrorism. That's why we're going to have to reinforce our terrorist legislation and the rest of it. Well, I knew as soon as I heard Harper, say when some mad jerk killer, what he did, he ran over two army people with his car and he killed one. And then he got out of the car and you wonder, what the hell is going on? What is the guy out of his mind? You know, he is out of his mind. And I, you know, but they did no drug tests on him. He's known to the RCMP. They've already taken away NCSIS, which is our CIA. He's known to them. And they've taken away his passport. What a perfect patsy. So as soon as Harper, when this guy did this mad act, ran over two servicemen, he stepped out of the car, and I knew, you know, well, they got to kill him because he's going to tell a story about how somebody whipped him up and maybe drugged him. They didn't check for drugs because he was behaving in a drunk, insane way. And but he was dead. He stepped out of the car, and they filled him full of bullets before he could move a step, even though he didn't have an armament in his hands or anything. They wanted him dead. They needed him dead because now they have, and you wouldn't think terrorists. You'd think this guy's a crazy who's murdered somebody, an officer, and trying to run over two of them. He's just gone crazy. Well, Harper said, this incident deeply worries me as an act of terrorism. And what's to come next? And as soon as he said that, I was into my research because I knew the next one was going to come soon. And it did. It came the next day or within 48 hours. Another one happened in Ottawa. Same thing, a crazy guy. He was a drug addict. He was a petty criminal. He was living in a homeless shelter. Then all of a sudden, this guy, nobody's ever seen it before, all of a sudden this guy has a gun on Parliament Hill and he shoots an unarmed policeman at the or army person at the cenotaph, and then he charges, and then you see the video of this guy, which he's just gone berserk, and I think he's drugged, and he's been whipped up into a frenzy while he's drugged, and somebody's given him a gun. The whole thing's planned, and sure enough, to make a long story short, he gets in to the Parliament buildings, and everybody says it's the biggest terrorist incident and going on, all the gunfire and everything. All the gunfire were there shooting him dead through so many holes that he would never live. The guy had countless bullet holes in him, and he was running amok. And then, of course, that is the next act of terrorism. And then the Globe and Mail, which is our national newspaper, had a screaming headline, how far do we go in terms? And it was a whole 9/11 in micro form happening all over again.
John, whenever you hear the word terrorism, run for cover. Smell a rat. Smell a rat. We see this stuff in America so often. We see it in Israel. We see it in Britain.
Everywhere.
See it in other countries. The damn same story repeats all the time. You know, the same plot, different scripts.
Yeah, and they just run it. Now, what happened in Canada, that's why I was so glad to get it out. I mean, I had to. I just felt duty bound the way you do. But here I knew it was all a matter of timing because the media let it run. The public broadcaster let it run. They promoted it. They cheerleaded for it. And they just wrote, you know, endless pomp and ceremony about the dead soldier. You'd think that 10,000 people had been murdered. They just went on and on and on the same way. But in Canada, well, I'm not sure whether I was the first to get something out, that, and it went viral. My thing went viral because it just spelled all, you know, out what was very plausibly happening. In any case, in Canada, people didn't seem to buy it. And so it's going to work. It's going to bump up its polls. But, you know, it was the same as with Bush. The economy was tanking. The growth rate, the whole thing is about the economy. That's why he can run the despotism he does. He says, well, I'm good for the economy. I know what the economy is doing. And people swallow it because things haven't been as bad in Canada as elsewhere. And he's also, you know, just basically a hireling of big oil. And but the growth rate had halved within the last year or last 2 years. It had been cut in half. And that's, you know, that's not the great success story that he's been promoting. And then actually it fell towards recession in the last report before these two incidents happened. And he's also the most reviled and hated, loathed prime minister or first minister in the history of the country by far. He has destroyed every, most interestingly, and it feeds into this knowledge thing about the knowledge is the first recognition and response that is necessary for all others. What he does is he defunds and strips all public knowledge bases in the country. He stripped the CBC. He stripped the Statistics Canada. He stripped the census. He's now going after all the NGOs, the nonprofits, who, you know, for the environment and for justice and so forth. And he's taking away their charitable status, saying they're political organizations. He doesn't want any information out there that he doesn't have in charge, that is not corporate information, and that his government isn't in charge of. At the same time, he strips as other people. He's very cunning, because that's the way you get rid of any problem, is just cut off the information flow. At the same time, he's cutting off all the social bases. One can go through them. There's big cuts coming to health. He's cut off, social assistance has all been downloaded to the provinces and the cities. He's, you know, the idea of a minimum wage is just, not even conceivable. He's even cutting down the ecological watch bodies that are famous around the world. We have one where it was called the Great Lakes Experimental Area, and it was just one, you know, it was a series of lakes, and they were the first ones to find out that about how soaps, phosphates, caused algae in the lakes. I mean, that's a very basic discovery. They made that discovery. He closed it down, well, along with all sorts of other discoveries.
I've written about him a few times, not very often and not recently.
But
I
he's
wrote
like
about
Bush it. Jr., only much smarter.
Oh, indeed, a Bush alter ego, absolutely. A vile character, if there ever was one. And the Canadians need to find a way to get rid of him, if it's possible. I mean, a real destructive guy.
Well, this is why the terrorism thing came in. It was just so, like, my God, it's like, it's predictable. As soon as the cancer starts being recognized, they start shouting terrorism.
Well, that's the operative word, John.
As soon as it gets resistant.
Oh, indeed.
And they won't allow any resistance by alternative. They select the resistance like they did, say, in Palestine. But this is all across the world, all across the Arab world, for example, and we've talked about it before. All secular, progressive, socialist movements and governments, because they came, you know, during the 50s and 60s, they were dominant across the whole Arab and Muslim world, were quasi-socialist systems, calling themselves socialists. And they had to change that, and the way they changed that is turn them in, is only fund fanatics, only fund religious crazed fanatics who have no understanding whatsoever of life support systems. They're just basically destructors. Then you have the pretext to attack them. But there was two moves. First of all, you had to get rid of all the socialist bases. and then you go after what you put in its place. Like, for example, Afghanistan would be a perfect example of this. Afghanistan had a quasi-socialist government, you know, with equal rights for women, with universal schooling and so forth. You'd never know that. They never report it, but they did have it. But mind you, it's in the context of Afghanistan, which is basically, well, you know, it's not a developed place, so that you had all sorts of problems too. But of course, the U.S. then financed, as you know, the fanatics, the jihadists, to fight Russia. That it came in because they, you know, U.S. arms, U.S. was pouring billions of dollars, led by Brzezinski, billions of dollars into arms and mayhem and civil war in Afghanistan. And so the Russians counterbalanced that by going in. And then that's when the war started. You know, it's just a standard story, start a civil war, render the country totally helpless, then you can loot it and move on to the next. And that's the cancer MO. Because what always happens is you leave a destroyed society and life capital base behind you. And so they got rid of opposition by, first of all, deforming the opposition into its opposite. It's not, instead of secular socialists concerned about the material well-being of the people, their housing, their schooling, their health care, which was, you know, in Iraq at the most advanced level of the Middle East. That's why they went after Iraq. And not just the oil, it was the example, it was the alternative. And the same thing happened in Latin America. So once you've turned all, you've forced out any sensible alternative, and again, it all goes back to the cancer formula, that these things are inconceivable to the thought system, and they are warred upon as the enemy. And of course, that's always it, they're the capital E enemy, that all you know, all the media and the war machinery and so forth then attack until it's destroyed. But they, you know, we had a long period there where there was a secular socialized alternative evolving. That was the ultimate enemy, and they called it, even though it may not have been communist at all, but the term used to be communism.
John,
so as soon as they said the magic word, communism.
Let me give you a slight glimmer of hope. Not very much. I don't really put much stake in this thing, but I'm doing a short article on over 100 former top Israeli security officials, ex-generals, Mossad heads, national police chiefs, upset about the state of things in Israel, and
yeah,
writing a letter
good.
To
that's
Prime
the,
Minister
that's
Netanyahu.
The whole, see, they're back to the knowledge thing. They know, and once they know and they bring it out, that's, I agree with you, that's good news. But go
well,
on.
It is good news, and at the same time I say you need to go beyond what Israel is doing. I think on their mind is the fact that Israel has already become a pariah state, so they feel that something has to be done to bring Israel back into the good graces of the world community. It's heading very rapidly in the opposite direction. And at the same time, and I'll point this out in my article, where were they when they really mattered, when they were in power, when they had jobs, top jobs, generals, head of Mossad, and so on? Where were they then? Why didn't they come forward and make policies then? Why didn't they say these things? Now they're just observers on the sidelines, and the only thing they can do is possibly influence public opinion, and writing one letter, as good as it is, to the Prime Minister and getting it splattered all over the Israeli media and other media, you know, it'll be a day or two's headlines, and then it'll fade from view and be forgotten, and there'll be nothing following it. You need hard policies with teeth. You need these people going on the hustings and literally campaigning for what they claim they support now. But again, I repeat, where were they when they counted most? And at the same time, I'm delighted to see The names don't mean anything to me. I don't know who most of these people are, but I know the positions they held. When you see Major General, that's the second from the highest position in the IDF, Israel's IDF, Mossad head, equivalent of the CIA head in America. So these were important people, and they still have influence. So the fact that they're doing this, I think, is significant. Now let's see what happens as a follow-up. At the same time, I don't expect much from this, but I thought it was interesting enough to want to write an article about it, like a little crack in the armor of despair showing.
Oh, well, you definitely, that's what it, you know, it depends on you, and that's what you're so great at, is getting that on the record, get it on the record, and then keep, you see, once it's on the record, you can keep coming back to it. Even their own people understand that. I've heard individuals being very, like the guy on nuclear weapons and so forth, who sacrificed his very life for it. I've heard of individuals and social groups in significant numbers, but what you're indicating there across the domains of the military government, that they're coming out against it as bad. I think, you know, there was a Tory MP who was always just Israel flag waver forever, and he turned against it after this last, you know, where they then used, you know, they bombarded, destroyed, flattened the city, and then they used all these false pretexts for doing it, and then took, you know, hundreds of acres of their land to boot, just kept on going. Anyway, this MP said, when they did that, I lost my mind. You know, this cannot be justified. And so he kind of led a vote in the House of Commons of Britain. And Britain, this is another piece of news that goes with the other one, where we may be reaching a turning point. We may be a tipping point here, because the British House of Commons, and remember, Britain was the place that put Israel on the map with the Balfour Declaration. The House of Commons voted overwhelmingly, to censure Israel for what it's doing. So that's new. And that goes with these officers and so forth. And I have, you know, there's a well-known academic who's a friend here from University of Toronto, and she's Jewish, and she's gathered a group of her Jewish friends to do, you know, intellectuals, to do an expose of. Canada has the kind of armaments relationship with Israel, like Canada, Harper, amongst other things. He's number one cheerleader, and so is this old government for Israel. And that's why, you know, it's the U.S.-Israel axis that's targeting Syria, that's targeting Iran, that's targeting both. Anyway, they might as well be in their pockets. But he gets a lot of votes because we have a very powerful Jewish community here at the rich top. They love Israel, and at the, you know, when they're more thoughtful people, the Jewish people are the best critics of it. In any case, they're doing an expose of the military partnership between Canada and Israel, which in a way reminds me of the military partnership between South Africa, apartheid South Africa and Israel, where Israel supported it, gave it 95% of its military equipment and direction. In the Army and Navy, and a huge amount in terms of how to keep down original peoples and so forth, you know, so-called counter-terrorism. That, you know, that notion's been going on since the British Empire. So maybe we are reaching some kind of a tipping point. And I think knowledge is the way we understand what I found in terms of the, you see, once you realize it's a cancer, you can really predict everything that's going to happen. And so what's going on, I predict, and you're predicting, what's going on in Ukraine, they just used this stop of war because they were losing. They got this election, which, you know, a million people had fled. They've got, I don't know whether you know, they've got a martial law in there now that they can enslave the whole, literally enslave the whole Eastern population. They can pick them up and say you are required to do this, not just for army, but for digging ditches, removing trees. It's all part of a clearance program. This is a ethnic cleansing that's going on there. And that's the way the cancer behaves. It destroys people. It's eco-genocidal. So it will proceed after this phony October 26th election, which, by the way, was less than 50% of the, you know, I mean, we're talking about, we're talking about the leader, Poroshenko, has actually got 10% of the electorate voted for him in all, you know, declaring war in Yatsenyuk, who's gotten in, and he's totally the instrument from the beginning of his appointment by Victoria Nuland, is the instrument of the U.S. there, and he's screaming war all the time. The only thing that'll stop them is the resistance of Russia. And Russia doesn't seem to be too keen, and the Donbass people, insofar as they've armed themselves with Ukrainian weapons and so forth, they're not keen on letting this go on. But they're going to try. The only thing that will stop them, the only thing that stops the cancer system, is not just the knowledge of what they're doing and the knowledge of what is the alternative to it, which we've had set up there, you see. They've got an alternative. They've had an election. They've got a government. They know what they want. Is that it eventually comes down there, which is not, you know, I mean, Canada, we were able to deal with that problem. We just have, you know, two official languages, you know, with Quebec. We just have half the people in the civil service, or the proportionate number of the people serve, are French-speaking. We have independent federalism, that they have control over most areas of government in Quebec. Canada could bring that right to and say, this is how you solve the problem. We've shown it. But that's not what's going to happen. We can predict from the metastasis of this model that it's going to go on, and the only thing that will stop it as at the, you know, at the level of an aggressive, completely malignant cancer, is you stop it in its tracks by force of arms. And that's what worries me, is that once you get into that, that's no good. If you can possibly avoid that, you want to avoid that. And, the knowledge and the understanding of the alternative, which are the things that are repressed, are the things that can bring you on. And what I, by the way, on the knowledge, I know we don't have more than a minute or two left, but the key in knowledge, the key in understanding, and that's what I say, is that is the inner logic of all human development and evolution. And that is more, you know, cumulative knowledge and understanding. And it begins with language itself, which is specific to the species. The more it's used, the more it's shared, the better it becomes. And then the best expressions of it are, and here's my criterion of what knowledge is. It's not the knowledge of the knowledge economy that has no criterion and simply means what sells. What it is life, it complies with the life coherence principle. And the life coherence principle just means whenever you do an action or whenever you run a policy, it must be consistent with your common life support systems of whatever you're making the decision for. And if it isn't consistent with the common life support systems, like the atmosphere, like the species diversity, like the like the flow of clean water, public, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, one can go into all of the things that must be consistent with any policy, then you don't take it. And that's already developing, by the way. And I don't know whether it has anything to do with my books, but I've been on to that for for years, is that you've got to make it right at the policy level. The government itself has a what they're doing, they're calling it in Finland and elsewhere, a wellness criterion. So that the wellness, and I call it a life coherence principle to make it formal and exact, it just means consistent with universal life requirements. And you can't proceed. It's not rational and it's not knowledge if it is not consistent with or promotes. If it doesn't, if it isn't coherent with in either being consistent and promoting the life support systems we have, natural and social, then it's a no-go. Now, if you'd had that wellness principle or that life coherence principle governing policy in, now Finland has, and look at the wonderful society they've turned out to be. They have had that. And as I say, I'm using a formal principle that I can bring down to hard logical terms and quantify and so forth. But that life coherence principle is the key. And so what we look at as the cancer is advancing is what, you know, and I think Putin is on to, he doesn't use that language, but he does say the first thing about, you know, well, they're doing all the things to destroy the economy. That's what they do. They destroy societies. That's the only, that's the inner logic of this cancer system. That's all they do at every level. He's saying, well, yes, it is hurting in some ways, but there'll be no reduction of social programs. Let me say this right from the beginning. There'll be no reduction of social programs. So he says, also, that did you read that wonderful? It was really interesting. Long interview he had at Sochi. There was a gathering, a conference where Putin was speaking, and it just goes on and on. And John Craig Roberts reported on it.
You mean the talk he gave?
Yeah.
In mid-October. Oh, I wrote about it indeed.
Yeah,
a wonderful talk, John. A wonderful talk.
So that's why we favor Putin, because he's more on the life coherence principle side. In fact, he seems to be actually, or the wellness criterion side, he seems to be actually standing for that, which is, you know, a big, wonderful surprise. Another point that we can look at and say, maybe something is turning here. So,
I can spend the whole hour talking about Putin, but one thing I will say, he is straight talk. When you hear what he has to say, he doesn't mince his words. He's very straightforward. He's very forthright. And what he says demands that people listen to him and understand, because he is right on the mark on so much of what he says. And, of course, he's bashed mercilessly for it. John, we're getting near the end of the program, and I do want to say this. Of course, listeners know that today is Election Day in America. Unfortunately, anybody who thinks they can go to the ballot box and change things is living in a fantasy world, because nothing whatsoever like that will happen. Republicans and Democrats are two sides of the same coin. I haven't voted for either of those parties in at least the last 40 or 50 years, and I never will again as long as I live, unless there's a drastic change.
Unless Bernie Sanders gets in. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Well, I think Bernie Sanders talks the talk, but he doesn't walk the walk, I'm afraid, John. I've had my to do with Bernie Sanders in the past.
That's
another issue.
Oh, really?
But
well,
Steve,
I'm afraid to say, is a failed society.
The U.S. is a failed society, absolutely.
Yeah.
I wish I could end the program on a positive note, John, and maybe one day I'll be able to do it. I get asked, John, why I don't write about something positive, and I always say when I find it, I'll do it. Because things are so dire. John, we can look back in our lifetimes, and I don't think either of us can remember going back decades that things were at the state at which they are today. Literally, well, maybe humanity's survival is up for grabs. That's how bad it is. And whether it's America, rogue EU partners, Israel, the constant wars, the permanent wars, humans may end up the only species ever destroying themselves. And that's literally where we become. Either we destroy ourselves ecologically, or we blow ourselves up, or something like that, and literally we're at that stage, and we don't have a bunch of dummies around, lunatics we have around, but they're not dummies, and they should know better. Of course, all they care about
is
what they can get today.
That's the point of my metaprogram. They're just programmed like robots.
Oh, indeed.
You know,
indeed.
And that whole program that I was going over in today's program, today's discussion, makes everything they do predictable, and it's locked in. It's a mind lock in of the whole system, and it rules out everything. And then the only solution to it is what we do, was we try to bring to light what isn't known, and is of life and death importance. And then, in general, we can say that's what all human evolution is. And going through disease always makes the life host, develops an immune response. It develops understandings that that are far beyond what it was before. The whole of human history is an evolution of understanding and knowledge. And it's only good insofar as it's life coherent. And we see signs of that life coherent knowledge growing about the desperate situation we are in the cancer stage of capitalism.
Indeed, John. It was a wonderful hour. We are just about at the end of the program. I look forward to having you back, and we'll talk more about this and the major world issues. They don't go away. Only good thing, as I've said in this program before, is the only good thing is it certainly gives me lots of material to write about. I always do my morning due diligence to begin things, and there's just so much going on. I have to pick and choose and decide what do I want to focus on today, and I try to do as much as I can, and I hope I can keep doing it, John. We're not kids anymore. So we're getting up in years. I just hope my health holds out long enough so I can get a lot more
of
this down.
Well, you're sounding good, Steve.
I sound pretty good today. Still working on some problems, John. Aging. With aging comes problems. We know that. And at least writing I could do sitting down. I don't have to do laps around the block. But I do exercise every day, and that's what gives me the energy
to
get through the long day. John, again, many, many thanks for coming on. I look forward to another great discussion next month.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Thank you, John. And to listen.
Be well, my friend.
Oh, indeed. Indeed, John. Do make this program a regular habit and everything that PRN does. This is the kind of listening you should focus on, not the garbage of what I call propaganda TV. Avoid it. Avoid it. It's toxic.